Please be seated. This is our final case of the morning. Cleese versus Harbor Company LLP 69620. Mr. Eisenberg, if you would proceed. We hope to have these little wonderful things illuminated fairly soon. I'm not playing hide and seek with you guys.
They're called those hats. We're told.
I'm going to reserve 5 minutes.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Robert Eisenberg, appearing for the appellant. I'd like to start by reading just two sentences from a brief that the Arbor parties filed with the arbitrator earlier in this case, and it's in the appendix. They said, in determining questions under an arbitration agreement, an arbitrator enjoys a broad discretion, but that discretion is not without limits. He is confined to interpreting and applying the agreement, and his award need not be enforced. It is unsupported by the agreement. We agree with that. An arbitrator is not a godlike person who can do anything he wants and whose decisions will be rubber stamped by a district judge. Arbitrators cannot act arbitrarily, but in this case, we contend that arbitrator Sherman did that. He rewrote the settlement agreement. He ignored some parts of it. He wrote new parts into it. And then the district judge approved what he did without any analysis of the evidence or the law. There are two main issues here, the PLX stock issue and the interest issue. On the PLX stock issue, the arbitrator ignored the one-year limitation for paying the money and buying the stock. The arbitrator gave the Arbor parties a perpetual right to obtain the stock without any limitation. He ignored paragraph 2 of the settlement agreement, which said that after 1 year, Mark Guzzi would get the stock without any restrictions whatsoever. That's the exact clause, without any restrictions whatsoever. And then he rewrote paragraph 12 of the agreement, which provided four conditions under which the Arbor parties could obtain assets. And the arbitrator ignored the impact of the satisfactions of judgment that had been filed in bankruptcy court. And he ignored the flagrant 10b-5 violation of James attempting to purchase stock while he's on the board of directors of a company that's being acquired or the stock value is going to skyrocket. On the interest issue, the arbitrator ignored the express agreement for a 5.25% interest. That was an agreement that had been entered into by the accountants and the attorneys for all of the parties. Mr. Sherman had been informed of that, and in fact, Mr. Sherman had been the mediator at the two-day mediation that led to the settlement agreement. He was informed it was going to be 5.25%, and he didn't object. Nobody objected until 2 years later, and the arbitrator ignored those facts and ignored the satisfactions of judgment. Now, why are the satisfactions of judgment important in this case? You have to remember, this is an unusual situation. Mark's $34 million judgment was rendered by the bankruptcy court in an adversary proceeding. Then, after the parties settled, for purposes of paying off the judgments, the settlement agreement was approved by the bankruptcy court. And then, when Mark applied the value of the stock to his judgment and gave the Arbor parties credit for $4.4 million for that stock, he filed a partial satisfaction of judgment, then an amended partial satisfaction of judgment, then a full satisfaction of judgment, all in the bankruptcy court. The Arbor parties have never moved the bankruptcy court for any relief from those satisfactions of judgment. Never even moved the state district court for relief from those satisfactions. And never even moved the arbitrator for relief from those satisfactions of judgment. At the end of 1 year, Mark obtained the stock without any restrictions whatsoever. But as I said a minute ago, there were four things under paragraph 12 that had to be satisfied that would allow the harbor parties to obtain assets from the settlement agreement. First, they had to secure outside financing. Second, they had to substitute cash proceeds. And the settlement agreement uses the word and. It says they have to secure outside financing and substitute cash proceeds. Third, they had to exercise that right and substitute the cash proceeds before Mark entered into a binding agreement to sell the stock. And fourth, they had to do those things before Mark determined to take the assets as a reduction of his judgment. So on the very last day, the arbiter parties send a notice saying, we want the stock. They don't tender any money. They don't make any showing that they have outside financing. And the next day, Mark gets the stock without any restrictions whatsoever under the agreement. 2 years go by. James Guzzi's attorney testified at the arbitration hearing that after that initial notice, which was in February of 2010, that James Guzzi decided not to exercise the rights to PLX. That's testimony by Mr. Dimitri, who was James Guzzi's lawyer. And so then 2 years go by. During that 2 years, Mark Guzzi files his satisfactions of judgment, and he applies the stock as a reduction of his judgment, $4.4 million. And his partial satisfaction of judgment that he filed in bankruptcy court specifically identifies the $4.4 million as a credit to the arbiter parties, a credit against Mark's judgment. So he applies that. Then 2 years later, James Guzzi rears his head again when he's on the board of directors of PLX. He knows there's going to be an acquisition. He knows the value of the stock is going to skyrocket. So he makes a demand, a demand to buy the stock. And he sets a purchase date of May 3rd. And May 3rd is going to be is a critical date because under the formula that James wanted, he would be able to buy the stock at the value before the announcement of the acquisition, but obtain the stock and when its value had skyrocketed.
So but pursuant to the agreement that allowed for the repurchase, why is that really relevant to his ability to repurchase? I realize it adds value and so on, but he's able to purchase at the price that's available at the time.
Well, the value of the stock was decided earlier for $4.4 million, and it's relevant, the 10b-5 violation, and it is. I would use the word shenanigans in trying to orchestrate a scenario.
But the increase in price cuts both ways, as a lot of people acted. One wanted to buy it because they were aware that it was going up. The other one obviously didn't want to give it up because he knew it was going up. So I don't think either party, if you want to look at it from a clean hand standpoint, had clean hands in that. But the real question is, based upon the agreements that were in place, saying that they wish to acquire the stock, did it really mandate that at that first point when they at least made the statement that money had to be provided with that, or that meant that they just opened the negotiation for the repurchase?
First of all, I don't think there is any evidence that Mark was aware of the inside information that the value of the stock was going to skyrocket. James was, because he was on the board. But in any event, that goes into the concept of the fair market value of the stock. But the agreement did, as you say, the agreement required them to provide outside financing and tender the money, which they never did back at the end of the year, which was the time frame that they had in order to do it. And even in 2012, they didn't tender the money. I wanted to address, there's an email, a March 11, 2010 email, which was an email from the arbitrator. And the other parties here have contended that that was an award and that Mark needed to challenge it in district court. And without challenging it, he waived it. And we believe the law is clear that it was not an award. And we've cited case law from around the country in our briefs showing that the Nevada statute says when an arbitrator renders an award, then that can be challenged in district court. That email was nothing but a preliminary, partial, interlocutory ruling on an informal email that had no effect. And the law is that an award has a finality to it. An award is something that resolves all of the issues. So that really wasn't. And although my time is running out, I did want to touch on the interest issue just briefly. As I said earlier, all of the parties agreed. It all started off with a secret email that Arbitrator Sherman sent, a secret ex-party email that he sent to Mr. Hillstrom, who was the lawyer for the arbit parties. And he said, we've got a problem. We've discovered this issue. And it was, I say a secret email because it wasn't sent to Mark's lawyers. And in that email, he says, what do we do now? And he doesn't ask Mark's lawyers, what do we do now? He asks Mr. Hillstrom, what do we do now? All of the parties had agreed to it. But they claimed it was a mutual mistake, but they never were willing to accept responsibility for the mistake. Their accountant said, well, the lawyers told us to use 5.25%. The lawyers said, well, the accountants used 5.25%. They asked Mr. Dimitru, did you make a mistake? No. They asked Mr. Hillstrom, did you make a mistake? He refused to answer. Nobody would fess up to making any mistake, even though they were contending it was some kind of a mutual mistake. It wasn't. It was confirmed multiple times in emails. And Arbor never challenged it. And in fact, to this day, Arbor has never filed anything to set aside that interest rate. It was all Mr. Sherman's doing.
Mr. Eisenberg, I don't want to take up your time because I know it's complicated and you're going into some of the detail. Ultimately, I know what concerns me the most is our standard of review under Health Plan Nevada versus Rainbow Medical and some of the other cases we have. And maybe your rebuttal argument, you could mention that, why you feel we can really delve into all these details under our standard of review, even if we agree with you on the facts.
Well, the standard of review is not insurmountable. Because if it were, then there wouldn't be any judicial review at all.
Right.
And this court, and we've cited cases in the brief, where this court has reversed district judges who have approved arbitration awards, where those awards were contrary to the contract, or where there was no evidence supporting them, or where they were contrary to the law. And we believe all three of those things apply in this case.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
Mr. Eisenberg, I'm going to give you 2 more minutes. When you get back up, I'll give counsel 2 minutes additional time at this point.
Thank you, Your Honors. Dan Bowen for the Guzzies and Arbor Party. I won't really argue the law today to you because I think the law is clear and it's well settled in every regard with regard to arbitration, especially in light of this court's recent decision in Washoe County School District versus White, 133 Nevada Advanced Opinion 43, which we indicated we would be arguing pursuant to our Rule 31E filing of November 13, 2017. Let me move on to the interest rate issue. Arbor doesn't believe that the interest rate issue should even be before the court, as I know you are aware. We do not believe Mark is an aggrieved party as to the credit we received on Mary Ann's judgment. As far as the $1.5 million that the arbitrator ordered Mark to repay to Mary Ann, that's between Mark and Mary Ann, and Mary Ann's not here. So we question whether the court can really do much on that. But be that as it may, and that being said, let me move on to the merits of the interest issue first. All of Mark's assertions that Mr. Sherman and or his accountant commenced a secret investigation into the interest rate issue, along with being unsupported by any evidence or facts, is simply irrelevant to any of the issues that we're here today on. It's also untrue. The arbitrator issued an order on March 6th of 2013, almost one full year prior to the arbitration that occurred in February of 2014, for all parties and to the liquidation fiduciary. That order was sent to everybody to produce all documents for the accounting. Mr. Skolnick, Mary Ann's lawyer, read the order into the record during the arbitration. 3 AF 563 transcript, page 453. So any claim that Mark did not know that the arbitrator had ordered an accounting or that only one side produced documents in the accounting is just ludicrous. The liquidation fiduciaries never prepared a proper accounting and Arbor demanded an accounting. Now, with all due respect to Mr. Eisenberg, I believe he's conflating or confusing what occurred in the what's been called the marathon settlement negotiations that occurred in February of 2009 with mistakes made by lawyers 2 years later in late 2010 or early 2011. He must say three or four times in his briefs that the arbitrator, quote, imposed a lower interest rate provision into the settlement agreement despite the fact that the parties had all agreed to a higher interest rate, end quote. Mark argues on page 24 of the opening brief in support of his argument that the arbitrator exceeded his powers because, quote, the settlement agreement contemplated a 5.25% interest rate, end quote. That simply is not true and there are no facts to support it. The settlement agreement does not discuss interest rates at all except for the per diem interest rates set forth in it. Mark's was at the federal rate of 2.07, and Mary Ann's was at the Nevada rate of 5.25. Mark says and implies that the parties agreed to a higher interest rate at the time of the settlement negotiations in February 2009, numerous times in his opening and reply brief. Again, that's simply not supported by the evidence. Mr. Dimitrio, who participated in the settlement negotiations, testified very clearly that the parties did not discuss or agree on any other interest rate. Mark states on page 7 of the reply brief that, quote, the RAB contends Mr. Dimitrio testified that there was no agreement to change Mark's interest rate from 2.07, end quote. Then Mark goes on to say that the RAB cites 3A App 502 and that Dimitrio did not give that testimony on that page and that he merely stated that he did not have anything to do with putting the interest rate in the settlement agreement. Well, I'm sorry, but he did give that testimony, and he gave it on that page. On line 6, page 214 of the transcript, 3A App 502, I asked Mr. Dimitrio, quote, question, and are you aware of any agreement between the parties to change the interest rate that's per diem that's stated in the settlement agreement, end quote. Then some objections by Mr. Skolnick are overruled, and Mr. Dimitrio answers on line 17, quote, answer, I am not, end quote. And then again, at 3A at 506, transcript page 229, line 628, I ask, quote, question, was there any agreement between the parties to change the interest rate on Mark's judgment? Answer, no, end quote. Now, Mr. Smith, who represented Mark, also testified that interest rates were not even brought up at the settlement negotiation. Mark, in his reply brief to page 7, tries to mischaracterize Mr. Smith's testimony in that regard. He states that all Smith said was, quote, that he did not recall whether such a discussion occurred, end quote. I asked Mr. Smith the following question, quote, is it also true that there were no discussions with anyone at the Marathon Settlement Agreement slash negotiation at Mr. Sanfilippo's office or thereafter regarding changing that interest rate, talking about the 2.07%? Answer, I don't recall that that was even brought up at the settlement conference, end quote. That's a little different than saying, I don't recall the discussion. He says, I don't recall that that was even brought up. That is, so Mark cites in the deposition of Jeffrey Hart, 5A at 1127, to support his argument that the interest rate was agreed to be changed 5.25% at the settlement negotiations in February of 2009 because Mark gave up valuable rights in exchange for that rate. Problem is, Mr. Hartman was not at the settlement negotiations in 2009. He testified that he did not get involved in the case until March of 2011, and that's at 5 AF 1129 transcript page 21. He has no idea what was said or agreed to with the settlement negotiations in 2009. He only knows what the settlement agreement says. He testified that it was just his interpretation of the settlement agreement that the parties agreed to use the 5.25% rate. When I asked him on pages 19 and 20 of the transcript, 5 AF 1128, how he got that interpretation, he couldn't tell me. He said, well, finally, that's my interpretation. If the court disagrees with me, so be it. And they tried to cite the Peggy Turk, Mr. Smith's paralegal, as believing there was some understanding that the interest rates were changed at the settlement negotiation. But she was not privy to any such discussions and could not explain where she got her understanding. At 3 AF 602 transcript, page 608, lines 11 through 23, she testified as follows. Quote, question, and you're not aware of anyone discussing interest rates at the Marriage Fund Settlement Conference, are you? Answer, no, I was in a room with Mark and I didn't hear all of the conversations. Question, my question is, and I don't know if you answered it or not, you're not aware of anyone discussing interest rates at that settlement conference. Answer, and I said, no, I wasn't privy to that conversation. Question, or you never heard anyone discuss interest rates, yes or no? Answer, no, end quote. Now, as counsel pointed out, there was one other person in attendance at that settlement conference that everybody seems to overlook, and that was the arbitrator who was then the mediator, Mr. Sherman. Now, one would think that had interest rates been discussed or changed at that settlement conference, the arbitrator would have said something during the arbitration, or he wouldn't have had arbitration at all. But we did. It's quite apparent what happened here. 2 years after the settlement agreement was executed, and the lawyers for Arbor were trying to figure out how much money was still owed on Mary Ann's judgment, they ran some calculations and mistakenly used the wrong interest rate. It's that simple. When the mistake was discovered, an arbitration was commenced, and the arbitrator heard 2 days of testimony and correctly ruled that the proper interest rate was a federal rate of 2.07. There was more than substantial evidence to support that, those findings. All of the evidence supported those findings. Now, Mark cannot rely on estoppel because he cannot prove that he was ignorant of the true facts. Mr. Smith knew the correct interest rate was 2.07. He's the one that put it in the settlement agreement. He testified to that. He knew that no agreement had been made at the settlement conference to change that interest rate. And yet, as soon as he saw that the Arbor lawyers used the mistaken rate of 5.25, he jumped on it. And he sent a letter to the liquidation fiduciaries using the 5.25% rate to calculate what was still owed to Mark. He could not explain why he did it, and that's at 3 AF 481 through 82 transcript, page 136, line 14, through page 137, line 15. He also let the parties use the 5.25 interest rate and never said a word. I find that outrageous. He knew or should have known, and therefore Mark knew or should have known. He also cannot rely on estoppel because he cannot show justifiable reliance. The fact that he paid taxes on the excess interest rate is not justifiable. Reliance is not, we cited a wealth of cases in the briefs that he cannot rely on the other counsel's statements or assertions in litigation. That's not justifiable reliance. The last reason Mark can't rely on estoppel is because he can't show detrimental reliance. And that's why I said the fact that he paid the taxes is not detrimental reliance. All he has to do is file an amended return. Now, they say we concede that those cases that they filed, that they argue on satisfaction of judgment, were right. We concede that those cases say what they say. None of them say that a party cannot sue for a refund of an overpayment once a satisfaction judgment has been filed. Mark argues that a judgment cannot be changed after a satisfaction judgment has been filed. No one is trying to change the judgment. It is plain common sense that a creditor cannot unilaterally file a satisfaction judgment and cut off a debtor's right to sue for an overpayment. The only case anyone could find on that was a case of State v. Platt. 786 South 2nd, 89, Louisiana, 2001. The court held that that argument was without merit. And now as to the voluntary payment doctrine, which they argue, Nevada Association of Services holds that the voluntary payment doctrine is an affirmative defense. Mark never pled or argued the voluntary payment doctrine, not in the arbitration, not in the district court. Not a single word was said about it anywhere. He argues that he cited State v. Platt, which was, he says, a voluntary payment doctrine case. It was not. In fact, we cited that case initially to the district court for the proposition that filing a satisfaction of judgment does not cut off a debtor's right to sue for an overpayment. Mark spent his time trying to distinguish the case. And it wasn't a voluntary payment case anyway. It was a unique Louisiana statute that talked about, quote, natural obligation. And if there's a debt that's not collectible, and you feel a moral obligation to pay it, such as in bankruptcy, and you pay it, you can't get it back. But that was a unique statute in Louisiana, and the case never mentioned the voluntary payment doctrine, nor did Mark in any of his arguments. And the voluntary payment doctrine wouldn't apply in any event, because Nevada Association Services makes clear that the payment has to be made with, quote, full knowledge of all of the facts, end quote. Respondents did not have knowledge of the mistake when the payment was made. Respondents did not even make the payment. The payment was made by Mark and Mary Ann from the proceeds of the sale of the London house, which they had owned for 2 years. At best, respondents acquiesced in the distribution, but had no say over it. All respondents ever cared about was that they received proper credit against the two judgments. As to Mark's complaint that the arbitrator ordered that Mark pay Mary Ann rather than Arbor, well, it was Mary Ann's money, the money by the, it wasn't Arbor's money. Why would he order them to pay it to us? Finally, Mark's assertion that the arbitrator manifestly disregarded the law by not conducting any factual or legal analysis is outrageous. The arbitrator conducted a two-day hearing. Everybody briefed every issue. Everything was briefed. The arbitrator had everything before it, and he made his decision. Mark just doesn't like it. Mark also says the same about the district court, conducted no factual or legal analysis in confirming these awards. But the record clearly belies that. There's more than substantial evidence to support that. On the PLX issue, throughout Mark's briefing, he repeatedly challenges the 2010 award. Well, that ship sailed long ago. That was confirmed in 2013. Mark never appealed it, and that became a Nevada judgment. Now, if you can go back and attack a confirmed arbitration award 4 years later, after confirmation, then no confirmed arbitration award is safe in Nevada, and why would anyone submit to arbitration? The 2010 award is final, and it's binding on Mark, and the arbitrator was correct in enforcing the 2010 award when he did that in 2014, and he awarded the damages, which was also confirmed by the district court. Now, Mark's argument that he cut off James' right to purchase the stock by applying the stock against his judgment under Article 12 of the settlement agreement after the 2010 award fails on its face. By its terms, Article 12 only applies to assets owned by James. After February 23, 2010, the stock in the segregated account, the PLX stock, transferred to Mark, and Mark owned it. So he couldn't apply it under Article 12, because that only applies to assets owned by James. The arbitrator's calculation of damages was correct. It's a very simple mathematical calculation, but the stock was selling for it. And I know I'm running out of time. I want to touch briefly on this 10b-5 argument. And the appellant says that all the cases we cited on that issue were misrepresentation cases, which aren't applicable. But they overlook Bank of America, NRA Bank of America 281 FRD 134, which was a failure to disclose case, quoting from the Second Circuit case of DuPont v. Brady, 828 Fed 2nd 75, 1987, quote, a defendant can avoid liability under Rule 10b-5 for non-disclosure of material information by proving by preponderance of the evidence that disclosure of that information would not have altered the plaintiff's investment decision. Mark had no investment decision to make here. It was an option, it was exercised, and he had to tender. So 10b-5 does not apply. And as far as the argument that the 2010 award was just an email, NRS 38236 only requires that the arbitrator make a record of the award. It doesn't have to be a court type of order. The award states, quote, I order as follow, end quote. And then it goes on to set out the decision. The argument that the court didn't confirm the 2010 award is somewhat befuddling. The order states, quote, one, the motion to confirm arbitration award is hereby granted, and the arbitration award dated March 11, 2010, attached to defendant's motion is exhibit two, is hereby confirmed. I don't know how that could be any clearer.
Give me your closing thought, because you're over time.
There are about 6 points to which I'd like to respond. First, regarding Mark being an aggrieved party, he was ordered to pay $1.2 million. It would be an absurd interpretation of the aggrieved party rule to say that somebody who's been ordered to pay $1.2 million is not aggrieved simply because he was ordered to pay it to his sister instead of to the arbitrator parties. On the interest issue, counsel argues that there was no agreement at the settlement agreement to use another, at the settlement conference to use another rate other than the judgment interest rates. The fact is that the settlement agreement says it's governed by Nevada procedure and substantive law, and it doesn't specifically say 5.2% in it, but 5.2% was the Nevada rate. And there are multiple emails. And we've set out in the brief, it's kind of hard to track the email string, but they're all set forth there. You have Arbor's accountant using 5.25. You have Arbor's lawyer using 5.25. Then you have the arbitrator Sherman saying, where does 5.25 come from? Then you have Marianne's lawyer responding to that saying, that's the legal interest rate in Nevada. Then you have Mark's lawyer responding to that saying, Marianne's lawyer is correct. And then you have Arbor's lawyer, Mr. Hillstrom, responding and saying, we agree. So everybody agreed. As far as the voluntary payment doctrine, I've set forth in the brief exactly why we believe that was raised in the district court. And I would simply, for my limited time here, point to a heading in the points and authorities that we filed in the district court. And the heading referred to a payment voluntarily made as being a bar to Arbor being able to get reimbursement for it. Now, I concede we did not use the three words voluntary payment doctrine, but there's no rule that says we have to have used those words. We argue that they can't get the money back because they made a payment voluntarily. That's enough. Regarding the counsel argues that the 2013 award ordered by the district court confirmed the March 2011 email. And I already discussed the fact that that email was not an award and therefore wasn't the subject of judicial confirmation anyway. But if you look at the judge's order, what the judge did is he remanded it back to the arbitrator for further proceedings. It was not a final ruling by the judge on anything, really. And what he determined is that the arbitrator had jurisdiction to decide these matters. And so he remanded it back. And I was thinking it's similar in many ways to the jurisprudence dealing with judicial review of administrative decisions. What this court has said, that if a judge decides a case on administrative review but remands it back to the administrative agency for further proceedings, it's not a final judgment and can't be appealed, and that's just what you have here. The final point I wanted to make is counsel says that at the end of the year, the stock was owned by Mark and not James. And for the life of me, I can't understand his point, because that really is our point. At the end of that year, the stock was owned by Mark. It was no longer in the settlement agreement assets anymore. It was owned by Mark without any restrictions whatsoever. The 1 year expired, no money was tendered, and Mark was entitled to keep that stock and not sell it to the other party. Unless the court has any questions for me.
Any additional?
Thank you.
Nothing additional. We thank counsel for their arguments. This matter will stand submitted. We are recessed at 1:30.
I'm sorry if I had to come down in Marino. I'm not sure why this was set with a southern panel, but.